So I think I got everyone who's here their exams back. So the exams, I don't know, so the first exam you all did good on, the second exam you did better on. If this were Wall Street, we'd call this profit taking, I think. People didn't do terribly on it, but on average, people went down kind of half a grade, 6.5 were normalized points. 20% of you did better than usual, 80% of you did worse than usual, up to plus 6 points or minus 20 points on your average. So not the end of the world bad, but not good either. So the answers are online as screencast, just as the other ones were. So that's go to lectures 212, and then A212T3R is the kind of funny letters that describe the exam. Questions?
How many more opportunities are there to raise?
So, kind of repeating what I said, the purple is your current grade. And that represents two-thirds of your final grade. So you got 33% extra to do. Almost all of that is in the final exam, which double counts. There'll be a post-exam, but you know that'll be, I don't know, 10, 20 points out of, I think it's 700 points, 700 and some points that we have for total quiz, homework, all of that stuff. So that grade probably isn't going to change a whole lot. I think people are doing pretty well, generally speaking. People always could do better, I guess. No one has 100% circled in purple. More questions? So I was pretty happy with the home labs. People did. I mean, people obviously had problems. It's the usual story, people get behind and forget, but people again did pretty well. So again, lots of scores that were within epsilon of 90 for their home labs. And the plan is to kind of finish the book. So we'll hopefully start Galaxies today, which is chapter 23. Going, gone on questions? So the thing we talked about at the end of the last period was the end states of stars. And the virial theorem, you know, kind of tells us what the possibilities are. So you can't die if you are made of a normal gas and held together by gravity, because then if you lost energy, you just get hotter and hotter and hotter. You know, a characteristic of death is the body cooling off. So about the only way you can die is by having total disruption. And that, we think, is the case of the type 1a supernovas. Those are the ones where the white dwarf detonates its carbon-oxygen core. We can have something that's made of a degenerate gas as opposed to a normal gas. And in neutron stars, we have a degenerate gas made of neutrons. And in white dwarfs, we have a degenerate gas made of electrons. Or we could have total collapse to radius zero, and that's what a black hole is. So those are the only ways that stars can die. And we then kind of went over to look at them. Actually, I think a lot of the white dwarf stuff we had talked about in the previous lecture. So it's held up by degenerate electron gases. It's the end state of stars that have a mass comparable to the sun. A little bit more all the way down to smaller masses. It has a really small mass radius relationship. So if you add mass to a white dwarf, it gets physically smaller. And typical radius, I mean, obviously the radius depends on the mass, since if you add mass, it gets smaller. But a typical radius would be kind of like the radius of the Earth, which is about 1/100 the radius of the sun. So these things are really small. Because it's the electron speed that is producing the pressure that's supporting the object against gravity, and there's a speed limit. You can't go faster than the speed of light. So it turns out there's a corresponding mass limit, which the Indian physicist Chandrasekhar figured out, circa 1930 or something like that, about 1.4 times the mass of the sun. And we also talked about white dwarfs in terms of kind of exploding situations like novas and type 1a supernovas. Just a comment about exams, the phrase that I saw a lot and didn't like to see was that one about white dwarfs, that the radius was m less than 1.4 times the mass of the sun, right? So that doesn't make any sense. The m's are masses and radiuses are radiuses. They're not related to each other. So radius comparable to the size of the Earth, 1/100 the size of the sun, those are good numbers. A mass that has to be less than 1.4 times the mass of the sun. And incidentally, typically a fraction of that. We think most white dwarfs are more like 0.6 times the mass of the sun. And maybe it's worth reminding you that this circle inside a dot is the symbol we use for the sun. So if I were going to talk about the radius of the sun, it would be R sub circle dot. Neutron star, end state of stars more massive than the sun, along with the black holes, held together by degenerate neutron gas. And of course, what happens is that the high-speed electrons find it energetically favorable to combine with the protons to produce neutrons and neutrinos. So we get a much more compact object because of the greater mass of the neutrons as opposed to the electrons. They're able to support some upper mass limit. I mean, the same effect happens. It's the high-speed neutrons now that are providing the pressure that's supporting the neutron star against the force of gravity. But they can't go faster than the speed of light, so there's some corresponding maximum mass to a neutron star. Turns out it's hard to calculate because of nuclear effects. These things are kind of like big nuclei. And I don't know, something in the range of 2 to 3 times the mass of the sun is what people expect. I think the heaviest one that's been in any sense weighed is about 2 times the mass of the sun, and most commonly they come in at 1.4 times the mass of the sun, just over the Chandrasekhar mass limit. We've got conservation laws at work. So if we collapse an object like an ice skater drawing in her hands, you automatically get a spin up. Turns out the magnetic field is also increased as a part of this conservation law. So neutron stars end up being fast spinning, high magnetic field objects. And they produce radio light, and we see them as, they were first detected as binary pulsars. So the particular case of two pulsars orbiting around each other is kind of won a Nobel Prize and is of interest because it was kind of the first evidence for gravitational radiation. We see these two stars slowly approaching each other, and the only way we can figure out that energy is being lost is in the form of gravitational radiation. What you calculate the gravitational radiation loss according to Einstein's formula matches the rate at which they are coming together. So looks like that's a detection of the law. Well, it is a detection of energy loss which matches what gravitational radiation would be. It's not a direct measurement of gravitational radiation. So there are people who are very much in the business of trying to directly detect gravitational radiation, but it turns out it's a hard problem. Black holes, total collapse, in some sense to a mathematical point, but because the extreme gravitational force, you reach a point where the escape velocity is more than the speed of light, so you can't actually get close to that mathematical singularity at the origin. So these things are, this no escape radius is called the Schwarzschild radius or the event horizon, and it depends on the mass. The more massive objects have larger event horizons, Schwarzschild radiuses. For something the mass of the sun, it would be even smaller than a neutron star, say 3 kilometers. We call them black holes because light can't escape, but then Hawking found this kind of footnote that says that in fact a little bit of light can escape from a black hole. We detect these guys as, since they themselves are, Hawking radiation aside, which is undetectably small for any normal size black hole, we detect these things in binaries where somebody is dumping material onto the black hole, and before it goes through the Schwarzschild radius, it forms an accretion disk, and the energy that it's losing as it goes down that hole occurs as heat. So we have a very hot accretion disk, so we see X-rays from the black hole. Questions? Okay, so in the context of black hole, we're starting to talk about relativity. So at high speeds, kind of common sense ideas of space and time break down, as Einstein made famous in 1905. So it's important to recognize that if you were traveling at high speeds, you wouldn't see anything funny. So if you were traveling in an airplane that was going at, you know, 0.999% of the speed of light, you know, according to you, your watch would be running fine, meter sticks would all look normal. But when somebody looks at you going at those sort of high speeds, that's when we see these odd effects. So somebody from the outside would say that your clocks are running slow and your meter sticks are shrunk, that's Lorentz contraction, and that you may think your clocks are synchronized but between the front and the rear of the plane, but they don't look synchronized. So these sort of strange phenomena are very well tested. And we have a tendency to think that they only happen at high speeds, but they happen at all speeds. It's just that the effect is very, very, very small. But people have used very precise instruments to measure these effects at kind of common speeds, like the speeds of real airplanes, and it all works out. So special relativity seems to be very well confirmed, at least at this point. It's kind of worth commenting that special relativity 1905 is actually contained inside of Maxwell's theory of electricity and magnetism. People didn't really understand that Maxwell's theory, which was published around 1860, required special relativity. So Einstein was the guy who put it all together in a nice, convenient package. The fact that he wasn't the only person thinking about it is, you know, present in these names. Like Lorentz is another guy who is thinking about these same issues, but Einstein is the name that we correctly associate with all of these ideas. So once special relativity came out, it was clear that everything Newton did was pretty much wrong, and so it had to be replaced. And in 1915, he came out with what's called general relativity, which is a replacement for Newtonian gravity. And instead of having the idea of forces pushing things around, we have the idea that space-time is curved and that objects are really moving in straight lines. They just seem to have curved paths because the space is curving around them. So the amount of curvature is determined by the amount of mass. So the usual statement is that mass tells space how to curve, and curved space tells particles how to move. Questions on any of that? Well, it turns out that in the last week there's been details fleshed out on black holes. So I can give you some kind of recent numbers about a particular black hole. It's kind of the best candidate for a stellar-sized black hole. So this is the black hole. It's called Cygnus X1. So Cygnus, of course, is making reference to this is an object that's in the constellation Cygnus. And you remember Cygnus is the Northern Cross, right? So we have Deneb here, we have Albireo there. I know it's kind of about there. It's the object we're talking about isn't visible with your eyes. It's a ninth magnitude star. And it's a blue supergiant star, so an O1 star. You can see this with your binoculars if you really wanted to. And what we know what's going on in this is we have this supergiant star that is sitting really close to, it's being pushed around by an object which we see in X-rays. And because this is a binary situation, we can get the masses now pretty well. So this dot that's pushing around this O-type star has a mass of about 15 times the mass of the Sun. And this O-type star has a mass that's about 19 times the mass of the Sun. And they're orbiting around their common center of mass in about 5.6 days. So these two stars are closer together than Mercury is to the Sun. You can see masses that are roughly 10 times that of the Sun. And what's happening is this O star material is forming an accretion disk that's producing the X-rays that we talked about. And we've said before that when we have accretion disks, we often have bipolar jets. So we also see bipolar jets coming off of this object. When I use the word see, I don't mean that there's a picture like that that we can ever make. These objects are way too close together. We just see them as one dot in the sky. But putting together all of the facts that these things are spectroscopic binary, so we have Doppler shifts for the O stars, we can find these masses and these distances and these times, all with pretty good accuracy. So no neutron star could come close to weighing 15 times the mass of the sun. So whatever that compact object is, it can't be a neutron star. So by exception, we figure out that it has to be a black hole, right? So if somebody finds that there is another possibility between neutron stars and black holes, maybe that's what it is. But all we know is that it's not a neutron star and it's very small, and it fits all of the facts for a black hole. As you might expect for something that's compact, it's rotating really fast. It's going about 800 revolutions per second. So that's comparable to the fastest pulsars that we've experienced. And it's kind of no surprise, if you have material that is spiraling down, it's going to spin up that object to high speeds. Turns out we can do the calculations, and this object has to be fairly young, something like 5 million years old. Right, and that's small change, right? 1,000th the age of the Earth, right, which is 4.7 billion years old. So this is a fairly young object, and that goes along with it being a massive star, right? They don't live very long. We can get the age of this star because it's in a cluster of stars, very similar to the exam question that we talked about, right, where we have a bunch of OB stars, and so we know it has to be a young cluster. Okay, so these are so-called stellar mass black holes. For reasons that we'll talk about today, for years people were not convinced that they were possible. They were always a mathematical solution to Einstein's equation, but they have some pretty odd properties. And this seems to be the best candidate for a stellar-sized black hole. As we'll say in a couple of days, it looks like there are huge black holes at the center of most galaxies, or at least many galaxies. Okay, so I don't know, this should sound very familiar, but the other number I can put on here is the distance. This thing is about 6,000 light years away. And it's actually the new distance measurement that allows the somewhat precise values for all of this. And at 6,000 light years, you can guess that this wasn't done with parallax, right? Which is only good out to maybe 300 light years or so. Questions? All right. I want to pick up on general relativity where we left it with this idea of curved space. What exactly does that mean, and how could we, in fact, kind of measure it? And the picture that you see in all of the books, ours included, about black holes, you see things that are kind of looking like this. And the kind of question is, what do these pictures mean? So maybe one way of starting out is to go down a dimension, and instead of thinking about space being curved, let's think about pieces of paper being curved. So how could we, if we were an ant sitting on paper, how could we tell that it was curved, that it wasn't a flat sheet of paper? And one way you could do this is by looking for violations of Euclidean geometry. Right? right? So Euclidean geometry applies to flat space. And if we were an ant on a sphere, things could be different. So for example, you know that one of Euclid's theorems is that if you make a triangle and you add up all of the interior angles, you have to get 180 degrees. But I can show you a triangle drawn on the Earth that has 270 degrees, right? So all I need to do is go down the North Pole, straight line, which is a geodesic, to the equator and make a right turn, go a quarter of a way around the globe and make another right turn, and I've got a big triangle that has 270, that each angle is 90 degrees. And it turns out you can show that every triangle, no matter how you draw it, doesn't add up to 180 degrees. If you make a really small triangle, it comes close to being Euclidean, right? So if we were to, you know, survey a triangle around this campus, it would be pretty accurately 180 degrees. But the bigger the triangle, the bigger the deviation is between what Euclid said and what you would actually measure. Okay, and you know that something has to be wrong, because if you try and take the peel of an orange, for example, and put it down flat, it has to rip. There isn't as much area in the surface of an orange as there should be given its circumference if it wants to lie flat. So apparently for a curved paper, rules like the sum of the angles is equal to 180 degrees, or that the area of a circle is pi r squared, those things all prove to be false. And really the idea is just to take these, I mean, if we're an ant, we don't know about the dimension that things are curved in. The idea is to take these same ideas up to space as we know it. So if our space were embedded in a higher dimensional space and it were bent, then the distances between points would not be those given by Euclid. So if we made a big pitcher of water that's in the shape of a sphere, and we could fill up that pitcher with water, there might be more or less volume. Right? According to Euclid, the volume of a sphere turns out is 4/3 pi r cubed. But maybe if we make the sphere big enough, the volume would be more or less than that given by Euclid. So when we're talking about curved space, in some sense, all we're talking about is violations of the axioms that you were taught in high school about geometry. Spheres having volumes that aren't given by 4/3 pi r cubed, and triangles having angles that don't add up to 180 degrees if we have big enough stuff. So let's take a look at kind of how that works in action in sort of this sort of picture. So imagine, if you will, that there's a black hole right at the center of this drawing. Now, since it's a black hole, what we absolutely can't do is to attach a rope to that point and pull it out and make circles, right? Because we can't reach the center. As soon as we cross the event horizon, we're not coming back. So if we're going to talk about our distance from that point, about the only thing we can do is apply Euclid's formula, right? So we can measure the circumference and then calculate the radius by taking the circumference divided by 2 pi. It's kind of the only option we have. And then we can step in a meter if you want, and we can make another circle around that black hole, and we can see what its circumference is. And what we find is that when we go in a meter, the circumference of this circle is not what's given by our formula. And the only way we can make it work is if, in some sense, when we go in a meter, we're not taking a full meter off the radius. We're taking some fraction of it. So it must be kind of like being on this sort of curved surface. And so if you were going to go to a black hole, you wouldn't see anything that looks like this funnel. But if you carefully measured radiuses and, you know, distances between these circles, they wouldn't match what's given by Euclid. You go in a meter and it doesn't look like you've actually gone in a full meter in terms of the circumference of the resulting circle. Okay, so I think that's probably less than what people imagine for black holes. That curved space just means that geometry doesn't satisfy Euclid's theorems, and that instead of the standard formulas that you learned in high school, there could be more or less volume inside of big containers, more or less circumference inside of circles. Questions? I mean, these are obviously big topics. So maybe you have miscellaneous questions. All of your questions have been answered.
Aren't they, like, finding the circumference, isn't that considered like a universal rule?
Say that again?
Like, finding circumference and radius and all that jazz. Isn't that considered a universal rule?
Yeah, so, I mean, pretty much undoubtedly you were told in high school that this is true. Well, because we lie to you all the time. So, does that surprise you? So, the mathematician's excuse for it would be to say that they're actually not talking about physical space. They're talking about this mathematical idealization where we have these axioms and these are the consequences. And any relationship between mathematics and the real world is just happenstance. That's what they'll tell you, that they are building imaginary worlds and they're seeing how those imaginary worlds work. But obviously the only reason you take mathematics is because you want to apply it to the real world, or at least most people. Some people, like my sister, are mathematicians and they care about these imaginary worlds. But yeah, I think I will say not me. Mathematics is very useful for describing the real world, and I care a whole lot more about the real world than the imaginary worlds. So, and of course the other thing is people who do surveying on Earth, they use the Euclidean axioms all the time, even though they're wrong. Interestingly enough, the famous dead mathematician slash physicist Gauss was worried enough about this that he actually had paid for a survey of a big triangle in Germany to see if the angles did add up to 180 degrees, if he made it big enough. So he was actually one of the people who first realized that there were alternatives to Euclidean geometry. Euclid's axioms were usually thought to be obvious and self-evident, and there was no way they couldn't be the case. I don't know, did I answer your question? Maybe.
I have one different question. I was talking to one of my friends, and he said that they like recently observed a star following like that pattern of motion or something like that, and it's like significant because it has to do with renewable energy. I don't know what he was saying, but it was kind of cool. he was talking about like the geometry of that shape and how it was like an important observation to see like a star following. It's because we have that shape and we've used it, but we never observed like a star going through the actual pattern or something like that.
Well, so this isn't really a physical shape. There is nothing that you would see that would ever look like that funnel shape. Say again? You certainly see tornadoes, but I'm talking about around a black hole. There isn't anything that's going like that, and there can't be, because the direction we're talking about, the direction that would be up and down on that kind of diagram, that's a direction we can't point. So just as an ant on a sheet of paper only knows about the directions, the two-dimensional directions around it, it doesn't know about the up and down. The idea is that there are directions that we don't know about, that we can't point, and that our space could be bent in those funny directions. So this, the direction of that funnel is a direction we can't point, and hence could never observe in any sense directly. But it, the consequence of this funny geometry, you know, has effects on the motion of real objects. And we can see those in terms of Mercury's motion, for example, which is slightly different from that given by Newton. That was one of the first tests of general relativity. So we do have good evidences of stars going around the tremendous black hole that's at the center of our galaxy, following paths that Newton would not be happy with. But none of those paths look like that. More questions? Well, so what are kind of some of the consequences of just these general relativistic things? So it turns out that just as there are consequences to high-speed motion in terms of space and time, there are consequences to time and space in strong gravitational fields. So near a big mass like the sun or a black hole, it turns out that clocks have to run slow. Now again, if you're standing next to that clock, it would seem to be running perfectly normally. So this is just that somebody who's outside, away from that black hole, looks at your clocks and they seem to run slow. And we see this funny thing about distances where it looks like you're not moving as far as you think you're moving. And there are really funny consequences of this that made people wonder whether black holes could exist. So if you were to, you know, in the standard sort of Hollywood movie, somebody gets sucked down a black hole, it takes a relatively short period of time. You drop a piece of chalk and it goes into the black hole no matter what you want to do. And it turns out that that's not how it works. That from the outside, if you took this piece of chalk and dropped it in a black hole, it would never go through the Schwarzschild radius. You could wait through an infinity of time and it wouldn't happen. And that's basically just because the clocks start to run slow when you get close to this black hole. So it would seem from the outside to be moving slower and slower and slower due to the fact that its clocks are running slower and slower and slower, and these distances are more and more than they might otherwise occur. Right? It seems the opposite of what you would expect.
Does that mean you can never go into a black hole?
Well, so that's the so we're not talking about calculations, right? Not, we don't have black holes to actually put this piece of chalk in, but I'm pretty confident of these results. So if you were to jump into a black hole, then it turns out that doesn't work that way, right? So just as things are different looking from the outside as opposed to being, if you were to jump into a black hole, it would seem like you would go there in a finite period of time, in a relatively short period of time. And incidentally, you would see nothing special when you cross this no return boundary. There would seem to be nothing any different above that boundary than below that boundary. Well, I do.
So you would know that you're getting sucked into a point that's like...
Yeah, so there are problems with what I said, and that is, the first problem is, if we're talking about stellar mass sort of black holes, which we've mostly been talking about, then the tidal, remember these things are very small and have very intense gravitational fields, so the tidal force get huge and huge and huge. So the difference in gravitational force, as it were, between your toes and your head turns out to be so big that you spaghettified. So So they actually, that word has now been added to the dictionary to describe this process. But it turns out that it doesn't have to be that way. If the mass of the black hole were huge, as it is at the center of our galaxy, then the Schwarzschild radius is pretty large. It can be billions of kilometers, and the tidal forces get smaller and smaller and smaller at the Schwarzschild radius when you have bigger and bigger black holes. So you can actually imagine going into black holes where you wouldn't be spaghettified. And the claim is that you would experience nothing special when you went through the Schwarzschild radius. And, you know, someplace out here you could have light in orbit around that black hole just fine. The light would be bent just enough to keep the same orbit. Turns out the orbit would be unstable, but if you had things nicely lined up, the light could circle forever around that black hole.
So if you have this type of black hole, you could go and stand on a particular spot?
No, because there's no surface, right? So you could, if you had a strong enough rocket engine, constantly run your rocket engine against that gravitational force and stay at a constant altitude. And you could make this, theoretically, you could make the sort of measurements we're describing doing that. But once you went inside the Schwarzschild radius, no matter how strong your rocket engine is, you could never go out of it. But as long as you stayed outside of the Schwarzschild radius and had this this warp engine that could support you, you would be fine. And the gravitational force outside of a black hole, just a little bit further away from the Schwarzschild radius, would not be all that different from what it is that Newton promises you, right? So if you're close to a massive object, there's a big gravitational force. And Newton and Einstein have to agree at normal sort of distances and normal sort of masses, because Newton's theorem works great around the solar system. So Newton is 100% wrong, but he's 99.999% accurate.
What happens when you take the rocket away? What's going to happen if you try to go as far as possible?
So from the outside, you would never make it in. It would take forever for you to do that, basically because your clocks would be running slow. So from the outside, we would see that your clock, you know, would take forever to click to midnight, but to you, it would happily click past midnight, and you go through the Schwarzschild radius, and you would be taken to a mathematical point at the center of the black hole.
What would that look like to you, the observer, in the black hole?
So it doesn't look any different. It is a pretty commonplace thing to see in descriptions of going inside a black hole that time becomes space. And that is, I know why they're saying that, and it's basically garbage. There is something behind what they're saying, but nothing physically behind what they're saying. So, yeah, inside the black hole, things are more or less the same as they are outside the black hole. Now, exactly what happens at r equals zero, so that's, you know, all of the mass is now in a mathematical point, something has to be going wrong. Because you can't literally have that. So this is called a mathematical singularity, and everyone thinks that we need a successor theory to Einstein's general relativity to describe what's happening right at r equals zero. And people have worked on that for 50-100 years without success. It's a hard problem. It's one of the things that string theory would answer if it ever panned out, which I'm not betting on. More questions? All your black hole questions have been answered.
I'm confused. How can you never see somebody getting into a black hole if they make it into the black hole?
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, well, So let's say that the things are set up so that when you going into a black hole, and of course not coming back to tell us, have set it up so that when your watch strikes midnight, you're going to go through the Schwarzschild radius. So from the outside, we would see your clock getting closer and closer and closer to midnight as you approach the Schwarzschild radius. But a century later, you would still be, you know, a millionth of a second before midnight.
Oh, based on your watch?
Yeah, looking at your watch.
Your watch. If your watch can go into a black hole, it's not
based on your watch.
Yeah, this is your watch.
Okay.
So your watch, you know, from your experience, it ticks through midnight just fine, right? It doesn't seem to be any different than it is normally. But from the outside, we never see it tick midnight, and so we never see you cross the Schwarzschild radius. You're always, you know, 1,000 years in the future, your spaghettified body is sitting, you know, an inch in front of the Schwarzschild radius, hovering, you know, because it's been there for the last century. So you can see why people speculate that you couldn't form black holes, because how can you form black holes if nothing can actually go in lifetimes? I won't try and answer that question, but
so there's no way to go into a black hole. It would be impossible.
From the outside, it is impossible to see something go into a black hole from the outside. If you join the material going down, you know, in a small fraction of a second later, you're spaghetti.
You can do it, but you can't watch. Right? Is that what you're trying to say?
From the outside, things just look totally different.
Yeah.
It's the end of time before you go through the Schwarzschild radius. Seems surprising. And as I say, for long periods of... So the name black hole was designed to be not a term of endearment. It was supposed to show how stupid this whole idea was. Up until, say, 1950. And people have done the work and seen the effects. And there really isn't any doubt that black holes exist. So... Is there any way out of it? Yeah, I'm sure there are ways out of it. If there were some sort of compact object that is almost a black hole, but could have arbitrarily large masses, then maybe there would be a way out of it. Well, whatever is inside of a black hole, we're never going to hear about, right? Because you can't come back.
A black hole and then put it into another one.
Oh, so we're actually very interested in having black holes coalesce. So it would produce a lot of gravitational radiation. So just as accelerated charge produces electromagnetic radiation, the acceleration of those two black holes, so they've done these calculations, which I can't quite remember the answers, but I think the coalescent takes, you know, a small fraction of a second. And in the process of twirling down, they produce gravitational radiation, and that's exactly what these people with gravitational antennas hope to detect. They would exactly combine. There are nice mathematical theorems that show, for example, that the surface area of event horizons has to increase with time. It can't decrease. So we get a larger event horizon after we have two black holes coalesce. They're not made out of anything, right? There's nothing there, right? There's no surface to a black hole. Yeah, the only place there's stuff is at R equals zero. So it's vacuum all the way down. Well, I don't know about to another dimension. Ben?
Say we could get them out of there somehow, teleport them back or something. How would, like, say, two twins, if we left one here and one in the black hole, 100 years later we brought them back in the black hole,
So first of all, we can do that same thing and have done it, so we know it works just with velocity. So you put somebody in a fast spaceship, you know, going to Alpha Centauri and back, their clocks are going to run slow. So to what seems like us to be a century might just be a year to them. So the twins would come back together, and the one who stayed on Earth would be 100 years older than the other guy who has just aged a year. And so we know that works. We've done that exact, more or less the same process with elementary particles, so we know it works. And it would work the same with gravity. You put somebody down there, their clocks would run slow, so they could have this hovering spacecraft, you know, hovering just above the black hole for, you know, seeming centuries to us, and then they can blast off of it and they can see the future. So this is time travel in one direction, right? You can see the future just fine. All you have to do is in terms of special relativity, just go very fast so your clocks run slow. So you seem to age not at all for millennia, and then return to rest or go near a black hole. But going to the future usually doesn't interest people as much as going to the past. So the backwards time travel is also possible through general relativity. So people have worked hard to think about how you could connect pieces of the past to the present in the context of general relativity. And there are weird mathematical ways of doing it. But they are sufficiently weird that no one can really imagine how you could do it practically. But it's not ruled out by general relativity.
A really long, strange question. So we've been talking about, like, you know, going into a black hole, how does it look from the outside, does it look from the inside, etc. But before you get to a black hole, wouldn't you be dead, so there's nothing for you to see anyway?
Why dead?
Well, like in the binary systems, like with the accretion disk, didn't we say that it gets so hot that it emits X-rays?
Yes.
Like, you would be cooked.
Yeah, you can't, of course you could imagine good shielding or something. But typically if we're going to visit a black hole, the right one to visit is the one at the center of the galaxy, because it's bigger. And because it's bigger, the tidal effects are smaller at the event horizon, so that you wouldn't have the spaghetti effect, and there isn't an accretion disk. So it may be a pretty wild and woolly place at the center of our galaxy, but probably not nearly as wild and woolly as Cygnus X1. So I think that, you know, we're way in science fiction, right? So the center of our galaxy is, you know, 25,000 light years away, and we have no imaginable way of going that distance, and not dying from old age in terms of getting there. But if you did have a way of getting there, it would be the right one to visit. It wouldn't be that terrible a place to visit, and you could go through the event horizon without suffering this spaghettification. But, you know, so what? You go through the event horizon and there's no out. You have to get sucked to R equals zero, and then you do get crushed, if not spaghettified. But you do get to live to the end of the universe, so maybe that's the benefit. It wouldn't seem very long, but you could see the end of the universe from where you are. Questions?
All right, so I'm still a little bit confused on the, I know we're talking all hypothetical, so what happens if you remove the rocket and you fall towards the center? What are you going to actually get from the center?
So there's nothing there.
Right, is that where you get crushed, or I'm just confused?
So this tidal force is a problem for kind of normal sized black holes. But the tidal force isn't that big for big black holes. You would just race through it, and there'd be nothing interesting happening when you went through it.
So there's really nothing there.
There's nothing there, except at R equals zero.
So what's that? Okay, so what's it? So nothing's at zero, so you're just kind of, it's vacuum then?
Yeah.
You would go toward the center, but you never hit the center.
So everything would get crushed to R equals zero. So remember, I don't really believe that, but that's what that's what Einstein's theory says, that everything that's quote-unquote in a black hole is at a mathematical point.
Zero.
So crushed to arbitrarily small dimensions. And what I do believe is you'd be crushed, if not to literally r equals zero, to things that are effectively zero. Something about the size of one of these strings, if string theory turns out to be the case, which is way smaller than the size of an electron.
Then what, I guess, do they have any idea what causes the force? The gravitational force, the tidal, the waves, or anything? Or if there's no mass to cause it, what causes?
Yeah, there is mass. All this mass is at r equals zero. Yeah. So we have a billion times the mass of the sun, according to Einstein, into something that has literally zero volume, if you believe the string theories, into something that is smaller than an electron. In any case, into a very small space. Everything. Billions of times the mass of the sun.
So is our universe shrinking or expanding?
Well, yeah, it's... If you're inside a black hole, it's going to end pretty quickly in a shrunken point. But luckily, we're outside of a black hole. So,
or are we?
Actually, that's not kind of as crazy a question as you might think. People have made the argument that we're inside of a black hole, but I don't believe that. What comes closer to the truth is that we're inside a time-reversed black hole. So that everything is expanding away from a mathematical point. It turns out that at least those solutions are mathematically very similar. More questions? So, I've kind of put off talking about some dull stuff for a while. And now might be as good a time as any to talk about it. Distance, right? So I've said repeatedly that distance is the hardest thing to do in astronomy, and it's kind of the first and most important thing to do in astronomy. And in terms of this Cygnus X1 stuff that I was talking about, it turns out that the basis for that was a recent measurement of distance. To get this 6,000 light year value accurate to within a few hundred light years, that's the basis of all of this numerology that people believe. So what do we have to find distances? And the reason for talking about it now is that we're trying to figure out what's going on with our galaxy. So, I mean, we will soon be talking about the stuff that makes up our galaxy. And in order to make maps like this of our galaxy, we have to have some way of measuring the distance to objects, to put together this picture of what our galaxy is like. And it turns out that because distance's measurement is hard, people have been confused for long periods of time about the shape and structure of our galaxy. And that's something we'll talk about in great detail in the future. But let's start by just thinking about ways we can measure distances. So, trigonometric parallax, that's the gold standard. That's surveying, but that's only good for relatively nearby objects. Objects that we can actually see the change in angle as we go from one side of the solar system to the other side of the solar system. Right, so this is good, roughly speaking, to say 300 light years. And here we have 100,000 light years. So trigonometric parallax gets us no place. If we look at all of the stars within 300 light years of us, they're just randomly arrayed. We don't see any structure in how they're put together. We see nothing like this structure that we're talking about here. So if we're going to see structure, we need to have ways of getting further distances, much further distances. And it's really unfortunate that people continue to use this word parallax for distance, as a substitute for distance. So this is the only one that is literally based on triangulation. But that same word parallax will occur in a lot of these same names. Okay, so it's only this one that really has to do with changing angles, right, as the sun, as the Earth goes around in its orbit around the sun. What's really involved for all the other methods is the distance modulus. And I hope you remember from the last exam that the distance modulus is the difference between the apparent magnitude and the absolute magnitude. So the apparent magnitude is easy to measure. That's just how bright something seems to be in the sky, right? Hipparchus had written down what he thought the brightnesses of stars seemed to be. And if we have the distance modulus, there's a nice relationship between the distance modulus and the actual distance. And we're never going to use this relationship, but I just indicate that if we knew that the distance modulus was 6, we could actually figure out what the distance was in light years. Maybe I should put a little bit of an asterisk there. So the absolute magnitude, that's the wattage of the star. That's how bright it is, kind of absolutely. So the idea here is if you see how bright something seems to be and you know how bright it is actually, you can figure out what the distance is, because you know that the intensity of light falls off like 1 over the distance squared. So if we were twice as far from the sun as we are, the luminosity or the brightness of the sun would seem to go down by a factor of 4. And if we didn't know where we were in the solar system, we could just see how bright the sun seemed to be, and we could figure out what distance we are from the sun using that formula. Now, the problem here is that this formula is assuming that the only thing that happens to sunlight as it moves away from a star is it's being diluted by going over bigger and bigger spheres. Right? But there's something else that could happen, right? Dust could get in the way. Dust is another way that stars could be made dimmer in addition to being very far away. So there's this trade-off then between a star that is dim because we're seeing it through a cloud of dust, and a star that is dim because it's in fact very distant. And that's been a continual problem for astronomy. Space, particularly space in the solar system, seems to be transparent. So people have always assumed that there wasn't any dust. And that's 99% of the time, that's a good assumption. Most of the universe does seem to be dust-free. But there are clouds, you know, more or less randomly around that can really screw it up. So if you pick a random direction, there probably isn't much dust in that direction, but there are lots of directions in which you look. There are clouds of dust that are going to make things seem dimmer than they are. Okay, so the apparent magnitude, that's easy to measure. The absolute magnitude, if we know it, then we've got the distance modulus, and if we assume that there's no dust, we can use that relationship to get the distance. So mostly what we're after is ways of finding the absolute magnitude of a star. If we've got that and we ignore the dust problem, we'll be all set. So kind of the first way of finding the absolute magnitude goes back to the HR diagram. So this is an HR diagram that's based on the Hipparchus satellite. And what we see here is the color of stars. And you remember, colors of stars is another way of saying the temperature of stars. It's another way of saying the spectral type. We could plot any of those things. But here they've plotted the color of stars versus the absolute magnitude. And you can see that you could measure the color of a star, and you could read off what the absolute magnitude is of that star, and you could get the distance to that star. Okay, so this is confusingly called spectroscopic parallax. So the idea is that we can go from the spectral type, or the color, for example, And from that, we can get the absolute magnitude. Now, we have to worry a little bit, because if we measure the colors to, say, be about 1, most likely it's going to be this, but it could be that just as well. So main sequence stars, which is the most common type of stars, they're on this diagram. These guys are all various types of giant stars. So spectroscopic parallax and either the assumption or the measurement that we're on the main sequence, that we have luminosity class 5, that'll give us the absolute magnitude from which we can get the distance. Okay, and I don't know, this isn't a bad way, but notice again that if we had, say, a color, incidentally, for reference purposes, the color of the sun is relatively close to 0.5. So if I'm talking about a color of 1, I'm talking about a pretty red star. But if we talk about a color index of 1, and we know that we're not giant, we know we're on the main sequence, there's a noticeable range here of possibilities, right? It's not like there's a possibility. So that's going to lead to a certain range of possibilities for the absolute magnitude. And it turns out that this range of possibilities often allows the distances to be off by a factor of 2, right? So maybe Cygnus X1 isn't at 6,000 light years, maybe it's at 12,000 light years, or maybe it's at 3,000 light years. So we'd like to do a little bit better, have a more precise relationship between the color and the magnitude of the star. And kind of the next step up on this is called main sequence fitting. So if we have an open cluster, we don't have one star, we've got thousands of stars. And we can measure the color of all of those stars, and we can get the advantage that you get from averaging. And so not just the random variation, we can do better with averaging. So we can basically average the spectroscopic parallax over the 1,000 stars that are in an open cluster. So the upshot of that is if we have a star that's a member of an open cluster, we have a much better idea about its distance than we do for an average so-called field star. Right, so the sun isn't part of an open cluster today. So if some extraterrestrials were trying to figure out how distance to the sun, their only option would be this spectroscopic parallax. So they'd be kind of automatically uncertain by a pretty large margin. But, something is better than nothing. Okay, so main sequence fit, you need an open cluster. Now as we get further and further away, it's going to be important to have brighter and brighter objects so we can pick them out. And if we just have an average brightness object whose distance we're trying to measure, it's going to be hard to distinguish it from a million other sorts of objects. So brightness is also a benefit for these sorts of distance measurement. And the measurement method that we've talked about before is in terms of Cepheid variable stars. So if you look kind of at the numbers, the star's absolute magnitude that we've been talking about for main sequence stars kind of goes up to about 0. Remember, and these are even brighter objects. Here with Cepheid variable stars, we have objects that are brighter. Cepheid variable stars are these stars that are ballooning in and out on a time period that is days or months. And so by measuring that time period, we can get the absolute magnitude, and if we've got the absolute magnitude, we've got the distance modulus. From the distance modulus, we can get the distance. And these guys are bright enough that we can see them at much greater distances than we can see open clusters of stars. So we can push out our distances considerably by particularly finding long period Cepheid variable stars. Now, just to flesh out this thing, remember we talked about that there are Cepheids that have metal content that's comparable to the sun, and there are metal poor Cepheids. So those are the type 1 and type 2 Cepheids. And there are also variable stars that are called R.R. Leary stars that are, turns out they're found mostly in globular clusters, and they have more or less a constant magnitude. So something that has more or less a constant magnitude is sometimes called a standard candle. Right, because we kind of don't have to do as much work for those. We don't have to figure out what the magnitude is. All R.R. Leary stars have pretty much the same magnitude. But they're not all that bright. So they're not actually good for getting further and further distances. So if we're looking for something that's brighter than these are typically supergiant class A stars, you know what? That's about as bright as stars get. Well, they do get noticeably brighter than that, but not maybe not hugely brighter than that. So the next kind of object that is extraordinarily bright but rare and has pretty much the same brightness every time it explodes are type 1 supernovas. We think that all of these things are the same thing. They're white dwarfs. They're just going over the Chandrasekhar mass limit. And so they should have, you know, it's the same thing. It's the same firecracker that it's exploding every time. So it should have pretty much the same brightness. And these guys have an absolute magnitude that is about 19 point, did I write it down? Minus 19.3. So they're substantially brighter than the Cepheid variable stars, so they're good at even further distances. But they're really rare. So with my own eye, I've only seen one type 1 supernova in my life. There are much dimmer ones that people have measured, maybe even hundreds per year at this point, because people are very actively searching them out. But they're, generally speaking, distant and rare objects. And there hasn't been one in our galaxy in many centuries. So they haven't been useful to get distances in our galaxy, just to other galaxies. And kind of for the record, just for this list, there's the Telly-Fisher method, which I need to explain at some future date. But it doesn't have to do with stars, it has to do with whole galaxies, measuring the brightness of a whole galaxy. And since whole galaxy include hundreds of billions of stars, they're hundreds of billions of times brighter than any single star, so we can use that to get distances that are even further out. Okay, so there are a bunch of other kind of specialized methods that are used. And in particular, the specialized method that was used to get the distance to Cygnus X1 was using radio telescope parallaxes. So remember we said that radio telescopes have much better resolution than optical telescopes, so we can measure much smaller angles with radio telescopes than we can measure with optical telescopes. But most sources are not sources of radio light, strong radio light. So it's not a good way usually to find the distances to stars. But Cygnus X1 is an unusual object and it produces a lot of radio light in addition to its X-ray light and its visible light. So it turns out that radio trigonometric parallax was how we got that 6,000 light year distance to Cygnus X1. Okay, so we obviously didn't get very far into galaxies, but we'll start galaxies next time.